Welcome to episode 232 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat tech, stadiums, and gaming with Josh Barney from Utah Jazz.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host, who wasn't invited to Fyre Festival, Sean Callinan.
Yes, I am Sean Callinan, and you can connect with me on a multitude of platforms at Sean Callinan on most of them, at Sean Callinan on Twitter and on Instagram and on LinkedIn. I say with a question mark because LinkedIn doesn't have a URL, so to speak. But a lot of people do actually set up their vanity URL. If you haven't set up your vanity URL, you should. LinkedIn.com/IN/Sean Callinan. You can find me. But set up your URL. If we haven't connected, please connect with me and say that you listen to the podcast. Or you can connect with me via the old-fashioned way. Now, I'm not talking faxes, and there's probably people under 25 who don't know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about email. Sean@sportsgeekhq.com. If you're listening to this podcast for the first time, you might be doing so on sportsgeekhq.com. Or you might have found us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or my favorite podcast app, Pocket Cast. Thank you very much for listening. Before I get into my chat with Josh Barney from Jazz Gaming and Utah Jazz, I just want to talk a little bit about the Pick My Brain sessions that are available to be booked. You can simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/pickmybrain. And you can book in for a two-hour consulting session via GoToMeeting where we dive in on the topics you want to discuss. You want some of my help, you want my opinion on what you're doing, with whether it be from a campaign point of view, what you're doing on particular platforms, you're trying to solve the problem that we're all trying to solve of cheeks in the seats or drive more revenue from your digital. It's a really good way to get started and really give your team a spark plug. It can be one-on-one, it can be a group session with your whole team involved. And pretty much you can be firing me questions and asking me questions along the way, or you can present what you're doing and get my feedback. So simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/pickmybrain. I'm really looking forward to working with you as podcast listeners and guests. Simply go there for a two-hour session or email me for more information. But that's pretty much it. And now let's get into my chat with Josh Barney from the Utah Jazz and now part of Jazz Gaming, their NBA 2K team. I caught up with Josh at the National Sports Forum recently and caught up with him to chat about his career at the Utah Jazz from a tech perspective and then how he got into the world of esports and NBA 2K League. This is my chat with Josh Barney from Jazz Gaming. Very happy to have Director of Esports and Technology from the Utah Jazz, Josh Barney. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
No, no problems. We met each other at National Sports Forum, and there was an esports session there, and I thought it'd be good to check in with you, especially in your role as Director of Esports in Utah Jazz and being part of the NBA 2K League. Before we dive into that and what it's been like being in the NBA 2K space, what's been your background in sports? How did you find your way into the world of sports business?
Yeah, I'm actually moving into my 11th year with the Utah Jazz now. My background previous to getting into esports space was technology, like my title had there. I was a network engineer for many, many years, and then moved into a role where I was a director of technology at Vivint Smart Home Arena, where the Jazz play. And my big project that I had while I was in that role was the renovation that we recently did in 2017 to go through and take the building from its 26-year-old history and yep. gut it, and then go back in and build what we felt was going to be the arena of the future from a technology standpoint. And so I actually was able to go in and be a part of that and lead out on the technology that was put in there. And at that same time, my projects, you know, obviously when you look at that, are surrounding innovation and what you go in and do. And that also brought up the stuff that I did in my personal life, and that was playing video games, watching people play video games, yeah, and all that stuff. And so I went to the business and said, you know, if we really want to look at doing some things, you know, differently that we haven't done before, we ought to really look at bringing in some of these competitive video games, yeah, as events to our building. And that started that whole conversation. And it, you know, so that was about 3 years ago now that those conversations started to happen. And then it just happened to be that about 6 months after we started talking about that, the league came to us and said, hey, you know, this is something that's on our horizon. Would you guys be interested into it? And we jumped in and we were one of the first teams to stick our hand in the air on it.
Yeah. And, you've gone far quicker than you're now in the world of esports, so you move very quickly. You've gone quicker than I wanted to. So I'm gonna wind back, because in that early role, like you're network engineer, you're setting up all the network and tech and everything related to the business operations and of the Jazz, because you're in that space, you know, we're talking 10 years ago when we didn't have connectivity in stadiums and those kind of things. And so you went through that process and sort of being deep in the tech, whether it be Wi-Fi and DAS and the like. And I'm guessing when you went through that renovation with Vivint Smart Home Arena, the fact that how much was, I guess, the naming rights, like you can't have an arena be a smart home arena and not have the tech. How was that that balance to get the stadium aligned with the naming rights and having a technology partner? How much was that big part of that project?
I think that the way to address that the best is it was a big part of it.
Yep.
Vivint obviously leads the way in home security and stuff like that for offices, you know, apartments and all that other stuff. And we wanted to go in and kind of change mentality on how we interact with guests when they come into our building.
Yep.
And so one of my first projects that I was tasked with when I started back in 2008 was, my boss came in and said, what's your experience with public Wi-Fi? And I'm like, none.
Yeah.
He was like, okay, well, we want to start looking at this. And so I ended up at one point in time, I flew out to Manchester, England, to go to, at the time it was Manchester Evening News Arena, to, you know, check out the Wi-Fi that they had there. I'd been, you know, Sporting KC right after that, facility opened up to check their Wi-Fi out. We'd gone to various NBA arenas for the same thing. We went to Barclays right after it was built.
Yep.
So we spent a lot of time and effort into trying out the different arenas and what their connectivity was. And we wanted to make sure that what we went in and purchased was going to be scalable and that it wouldn't be irrelevant the following year.
Yeah.
And that we would be able to bring on, one of the things that we had discovered as well in this is that when the Super Bowl happens or any other event, they have about a 40% take rate, yep, on Wi-Fi. And so we knew, you know, we've got 18,306 seats in our arena. We knew that about 40% of those people would end up having a device that they would want to connect up to our Wi-Fi, potentially all concurrently.
Yep.
So we went in and, you know, we ended up partnering with Aruba and deployed a Wi-Fi system that we had seen, kind of in action in just a little bit of an older version of it up at the, Trailblazers, up in Portland, and they had a great system. And so that was one of the things that, we liked about that is that we went out and looked, and, we've gotten to the point where, I feel pretty comfortable in saying that we probably got one of the best Wi-Fi systems in the NBA as far as arenas go. It's really difficult to go in and do Wi-Fi in an arena due to the reflection and all the other stuff. The broadcast trucks bring in their own RF frequency disruption. And so there's a whole bunch of things that end up playing into that. But
you would have had to play the game of where to put
the different antennas and find unique places to put them where it didn't hit sight lines or didn't affect the experience. But then, you know, then was there any of those with the stadium design where you were finding some weird places to put equipment to serve the purpose?
Yeah. So we had actually gone to Levi's as well, Levi's Stadium, and they had done some under the seat stuff.
Yep.
And so we started to look at what that would end up looking like. And at that point in time, we didn't really want to go in and core drill up through the ground to go in and do that. So all of our access points inside of the bowl are top down. So we were able to go through on the catwalks and get antennas that gave us the coverage that we were looking for. And then for our front row seats and then for the floor during a concert, we have an LED ring that hangs above our big super screen that we have in there.
Yep.
We went in and put 32 access points in that ring that face down onto the floor as well, so that during concerts and everything else like that, we have coverage on the floor there. So we really tried to be thoughtful in how we were doing it. And so we were lucky enough that we were able to do the top-down stuff just with the current infrastructure on how it was built. But having now done that and looking at what the future is probably going to be, going under the seats and doing that type of thing actually provides a ton of value. And so there's potential that when we go in and rethink this in a year or two on where we're at structurally, that there's a chance we might be going in and doing some under the seat stuff to you know, better that coverage.
So once you get that foundation in, and that was the initial challenge for a lot of people in your role, and a lot of the stadiums you're talking about sort of rolled out, bedding down that foundation of, okay, now the fans have connectivity. We've got a foundation of actually doing the cool stuff on top of that, because we've got the pipes, you know, effectively we've got the plumbing in place. What's been the next focus in the stadium and the fan experience to look at in the tech rolling into the stadium? Has it been, you know, because there's so many now, I guess, fan engagement options and, you know, concession technology or wayfinding, or how do we get people into the stadium? How do you filter through all of those options, and what are the things that you've looked at implement?
Yeah, so one of the things we've tried to do as well is, as you brought up before, we wanted to build the highway so that we had enough space for people to go in and do stuff. Because a lot of the time, IT is kind of the tail wagging the dog.
Yep.
We wanted to go in and have the business drive what our needs would be. But at the same time, too, they didn't know necessarily where they wanted to head on some of those things. So we had looked around and we needed, the ability to go in and do some things that we hadn't done before from an engagement standpoint. Yep. And so we decided it was probably time that we look at finding a new app provider.
Okay.
And so we went in and partnered with another company to go in and do the app on there. And so we, at the same time, decided to also change our ticketing provider and moved back over to Ticketmaster. So in the space of April to September of 2017, we gutted our building, we changed our ticketing provider, and we changed our app provider. And then the other piece of that was that most of the signage that we had inside of the building was all static signing, it was backlit signs, and we ripped all those down and wanted to move to a digital asset world.
Yep.
And so trying to figure out where we wanted to go with that, my biggest determination was I wanted everything IP-based.
Yep.
So we ripped out all the coax. And everything that we have inside of our facility is now an IPTV And we partnered with a local company here in Salt Lake who's been doing a ton of venues, sporting venues, as well as like local theaters and other stuff like that for signage. And so we have an entire digital platform now inside of our venue that is dynamic. And we can, through our back end, which is done through Aruba, yep, because of Wi-Fi, we can move TVs around, we can move points of sale around and all that stuff, and it just works wherever it gets plugged in.
So that's a lot to tackle, like that's a lot to tackle at once. And
yes,
and they're very separate projects, but also the integration is paramount. Were you able to get some or all of those pieces like integrated? Like, was the app that was developed, was this a stadium app, or was this the Jazz app, or was it a hybrid of both?
We partnered with Venue Next,
yep,
and so they're the app providers.
Yep.
I'm sure you're very familiar with them.
Yep.
And so we worked with them. So we've now gotten to the point where every one of those projects, and I'll always preface this, technology always brings headaches.
Yeah.
So yep, there's been bumps in the road, and we've been, you know, been able to go through and work through most all of the problems that we initially had at launch. But that in mind, I mean, it was literally April to September of 2017 that we were able to do all of that and be ready to go for our first event. I believe our first event was like the 26th of September. So we did this massive renovation, changed literally everything out, and we were able to go in and be open, ready for business, and then, you know, fix the problems as we went. But we were able to accomplish that.
What's been the it's amazing to roll it out. Then so what's been the response from fans? Like when you roll out a whole bunch of new technology or new apps and those kind of things, there's a fan behavior piece that has to change if they're always, yes, or you know, how is that experience? Because there's sometimes the geeks, and you know, count myself among them, like you roll out, you finish your project, you go, yay, we're done. That was a lot of work, which it was. But like some of the work, there's a whole bunch of work that has to start once you actually roll it out in education and onboarding and customer service and that kind of thing. What was the response from fans and I guess the adoption of fans of some of the initiatives that you rolled out?
So we ended up, we worked a lot with the Orlando Magic. We're good friends with those guys. And yep, we had seen a couple of the things that they had done with the refs that they had.
Yep.
And those who aren't familiar with the refs, they were employees that they had gone in and hired who their job was specific to helping people move around the facility and interact with the app.
Yep.
And so we went in and did a very similar type of thing as well with our guest services. And so we actually had a we had a group of individuals that would sit at all of our entry points into the building, and their job was specific to help people as they were coming in. So we had positioned our Wi-Fi as well to point at the parking structures that are surrounding our building so that we could onboard those who were interested in,
yep,
in it. We could onboard them onto our Wi-Fi system the moment that they parked, so that as we were bringing them in, they were already on our Wi-Fi. We could go through and help them through that process on making sure that they were able to walk up. And we went to kind of the wireless ticketing system, okay, that is called the Kezar system through Venue Next.
Yep.
So we use those as well. And so we're able to position those to where we can, you know, have our guest services just help people come up instead of taking tickets.
Yep.
And it makes it kind of a better experience just in general, where people have more of a comfort feeling walking in, which, you know, anytime that you can go in and make somebody feel good walking into your building, that's a big win for you. But we went through that whole first season really trying to help people understand how to get into our building and kind of getting the baby steps into kind of the changes that we had made. And then some of the things that we've built in as well that we haven't actually started using yet, we put in blue dot wayfinding.
Okay.
So we actually have about 1,900 Aruba Meridian sensors all over our building that are just ready for the business. You know, once the business has decided how they want to go in and do it, we can turn that on and be ready to go with that. And then with our digital signage IPTV solution, we incorporated that into the Wi-Fi so that if we ever get to the point where we want to start delivering content to the app over our people's, you know, connection on our Wi-Fi, we can do that as well. And that's already built in. We decided as well to go in some of our premium seating areas and supply those seats with Samsung tablets with a white label app that we went in and built with our partner to have 52 channels for TV so that if there's anything that they're interested in watching, you know, if there's a big game, you know, we have this with the World Series, we get it with not necessarily the Super Bowl in our building, but we have these events that, you know, people are interested in watching that just happen to be coinciding with our game. So we provide them the opportunity to have those things as well. And that's all done through our IPTV solution.
Cool. So you have actually you've laid out that, like you said before, that framework, that highway, and now it's sort of you're throwing the ball back to the commercial and partnerships team to say, hey guys, here's more inventory. Here's how you can engage fans in the stadium. We can do all of these things, and the cost has already been done. It's just a matter of now bringing the partners in.
Yeah. One of the things that was brought up in a meeting that we had internally this past week as well, and I hope I don't mess up on the statistics on it, but from the league perspective, I believe that we came in at number 3 in the league over their last measurement period, which I'm unfamiliar with what that is, but we were the number 3 in app usage, which is really awesome. So we've helped our audience who was not used to digital tickets necessarily. And all of these things that where we actually have a really good adoption now, and we're ranked fairly high in the NBA on that. So,
and I think that's really key. I mean, the use of apps and the required use of apps and the repeat use of apps is a real key issue. And like, that's where I think the stadium integration and the ticketing as part of the app start making the app a utility you have to use. And then that app increases usage because, you know, the getting people to go to an app and just look at an app for content and that kind of thing is really, really tough. But if you start providing the utility in the app to integrate and interface with the stadium, so to speak, then it's much easier for them to go, oh, that's where I am going to use the app, and it lifts usage and it gets people to go to it more often. It's effectively using your stadium as a marketing tool for your app in a certain sense.
Yep. Yeah, so, and we've actually created some of our partner stuff. Like in our fourth quarter here, if our opponent misses 2 free throws in a row, they actually everybody in the stadium is given with their ticket a free Chick-fil-A sandwich.
Yep.
And so we are able to actually track that then through our app, so that is not just something that we're doing for our partner, but we actually have data that we can back up behind that saying, hey, look, we had this many people in the arena and now we've been able to actually bring this many people to your restaurant to redeem this. So providing data to your partners is huge.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's far easier to track that than paper ticket stubs in multiple franchises around Salt Lake.
Yep.
Yeah. So now that we've covered your technology game, and you previewed a little bit before, you said you had a gaming background. You've been a gamer by nature, and obviously you're then interested in esports. What's your gaming background?
So I was introduced to video games at a very young age, so much to the point, and I'm going to date myself on this one, but I started playing video games before consoles were even available. My dad bought a Tandy TRS-80 when I was a kid because he's an author.
Yep.
And so I would actually get down and start playing on the computer, and I started going through the file system, and I found a folder called games and started playing in there, and then you know, it developed into all of a sudden the NES is released and, you know, we had the Atari 2600 and that. And my mom got a job where I grew up, you used to have to go to the grocery store to rent your video games and your movies before Blockbuster and all those. And my mom was the middleman.
Yep.
So they would send her all of the games and all of the movies to our house first. And then a week or so later, we would go put them in the store. Well, that meant I had a week to go through and play every video game came through. So I typically had my hands on every video game before anybody else did and was able to go through and play. And so I developed a love for the storytelling in some of the games. To this day, my favorite game of all time is still the original Zelda. It's one of those things that you develop a relationship with the games. And so I've played video games forever.
Yep.
And one of the things that I think is wonderful about playing video games is that there is such a high skill element that mirrors traditional sports, that when you watch somebody who's really good at a game, and you'd say, I love to do that, just like you would, you know, when you see Michael Jordan dunk it, say, yeah, I'd love to be able to do that too. That's a really close parallel. And so you start, you know, once Twitch really kind of came into its own, you know, Justin TV before that, you'd see stuff every now and again, and it built up. And then all of a sudden Twitch, you've got this massive free platform where you can watch anybody and everybody. And so, yeah, started watching it, and it was always just something that I did in the background of my life. So, yeah.
Yeah, that analogy of wanting to watch the best because you want to emulate the best is always the example that I give when people sort of they turn their nose up and say, what do you mean you're watching video games or esports? It's not really a thing. When I share that story and that analogy, they go, oh yeah, that's right. That is part of the reason I watch sport, or why I watched sport as a kid. And that's how I fell in love with watching the game, you know, for the same reason. So, you know, there is those parallels. And so, you know, I've been lucky enough to chat with a few people in the NBA 2K, community. Caught up with Brendan Donahue last year when I was in New York. It's now moving from season one to season two. So, Utah Jazz, or Jazz Gaming, as your 2K outfit is named. You want to take us, rather than going into the starting point of NBA 2K and setting all of that up, do you want to sort of give us a recap of what season one was like and some of the lessons from season one and what you're looking for from, you know, to consolidate into season two?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we actually had a blockbuster first 7 weeks of our season last year.
Yep. How long is the season for people?
It's 14 weeks. Oh, yeah. So the first 7 were really good. The second half of those 14 was not so great.
Okay.
So we were 5-2 at the beginning of the season, and then the league went in and did a patch update to the game.
Yeah.
And it changed the meta. And we just were never able to really go in and recover off of that.
Explain, like, I now understand what you just said. They changed the patch and it changed the meta. But I'm sure there's listeners that are still, you know, learning a little bit about esports. They might be doing a little bit via this podcast. Explain, like, that this is a pit that really blows the mind of traditional, you know, sports fans. If it were, you know, in the NBA, you know, if you were comparing it to the NBA, explain what the patch update and it changed the meta means to a non-gamer. Yeah.
I'll try and use my best analogies in this. So what that would be kind of equivalent to would be asking a traditional basketball player to only shoot with one hand, or to only use a couple of fingers to hold the ball when they shoot, something like that, that it changes the way you play the game. Not necessarily the game itself, like it was still basketball and you'd still have those things, but there were certain nuances. Like the center was a very strong position, in the league up until the point where that patch was done. And it kind of diminished the prominence, of that position, a little bit on there. And it was kind of some functional things in that that ended up, you know, being something that was very hard for us to overcome.
Yeah, it's like it's so strange. Like, effectively, a patch is, and the people who are geeks, and it's a software patch. It's an update.
Yeah.
And effectively, it makes some changes to the game. Some might be minor, some might be cosmetic, some might be major. But effectively, you know, when I explain, it's like the NBA changing, you know, the distance of the three-pointer. They're just going, we're just going to put it out a little bit further. And, yeah. you know, and guys are accustomed to shooting threes with their toes just on the line. You put it out another half foot and it's only Steph Curry that can hit those threes from now on. And it completely changes the whole landscape of the league. And it's, you know, it's something that's unique to esports in that, that the changes can come in you know, players have to adapt to these. Yeah, effectively, they're effectively like rule changes. You know, in a mid-season or, you know, 2 weeks before the playoffs start. So it is something from from a player and a coaching point of view they have to be on top of. And, you know, now I'm getting, you know, here's the patch notes and they're like pages and pages of notes of adjustments to how you play certain positions or different parts of the game that the players have to be all over and the coaches have to be all over. And it is definitely a wrinkle in esports.
Yeah, and that was actually you brought up something in there that was also affecting of us as well, is we didn't have a coach.
Okay.
We thought that we have a person on our team, Shaka Brown, that I am a firm believer that this guy will end up being kind of the face of the league.
Yep.
Going forward, he's one of the best 2K players in the world, and just an amazing individual personally. And I've very few times in your life do you actually get to meet somebody who has just got kind of a natural propensity to be a star.
Yep.
Like his personality, he's, you know, extremely kind. He's always wanting to be helpful. He's just kind of a really great individual that way. He was one of those guys that, you know, when you go in and look at that, we were like, well, you know what, we'll just have him as our captain.
Yeah.
And we thought that would work out okay. But, you know, that was another thing that we had that lesson learned from. So we actually went in and hired a head coach for this season.
Yep.
But yeah, the patch itself, that's actually very common in most other video game titles. League of Legends goes through that. So it's not just something that we have to deal with. It's actually, you know, just in general, there's every video game has a patch update that it'll come up with, and Overwatch, it has it as well.
Yep.
It was just something that, you know, it happens in the general course of how this is. And, it just became something that was really hard for us to adapt to. So we ended up, you know, going 0-7 after that patch. We ended up missing the playoffs. And so we were in, I guess, a lucky state or an unlucky state, however you look at it, that we were eligible for the lottery.
Okay.
And so we ended up getting the first pick in the draft, based upon the lottery system that way. And just actually had the draft here back on March 5th.
So explain that, 'cause there's obviously the NBA is trying to, and Brendan and his team are trying to emulate the NBA as much as possible in teams being aligned to the actual teams, but then also having the draft. But it didn't exactly work the same way, because pretty much anyone that was, so what was the process there around retaining players or not retaining players? And then effectively everyone that wasn't retained went back in the draft. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, that's correct. So there was multiple pieces to it, because we had an expansion process as well, bringing in four other NBA teams this season. So the league actually went in with all the season one teams and required that we retained two players.
Okay.
And then you could retain up to, I think,
four?
I don't remember if it was up to four in all. I think that's what it was.
Yeah, I think it was a couple of teams that did well kept four players, I think I saw in the draft.
Yeah, so you could retain up to the four, but you'd have to sacrifice draft positions, you know, which is obvious at that.
Yeah.
So they went through and did that, and we made the decision to retain two players. So we kept the guy I brought up, Shaka Brown, and then we kept another guy, DeMar Butler, and we felt that we could really go in and build a good core up with those two and then build a team around them. And so that's kind of how we went through on that. And so there was an expansion draft that was held where all the unretained players went into that expansion draft, and the four teams that were brought on were able to go through and choose their initial two players.
Okay.
And then we held the regular draft just back here in March, March 5th. And then that had an associated combine that they went through and did around Christmas time to bring in a draft pool. And then they went in at the beginning of February and did an Asia Pacific tournament to bring in a few more players in that. So all in all, we had 200 or so players from all over the world looking to see if they could get into the 2K League for season two here. So it's pretty cool.
So having number one pick in the draft, and again, the analogies with the NBA, to have the NBA 2K draft, and then it's not an NBA draft without Woj, Adrian Wojnarowski, tweeting, and it must have been a bit of a thrill to be having Woj announcing your pick and creating hype around the game.
Well, it's a lot of fun when you see stuff like that happen. It's even more fun when it's related to something you're doing.
Yeah.
So I actually texted that over to our guy, Spencer Wyman is his name. I texted it over to him and I said, hey, keep this one for your records, bud. I said, this is your Woj bomb. This is cool. So.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Explain to me how the Jazz Gaming and the Utah Jazz sort of, I guess, work in unison, how potentially you work backwards and forwards. Where does it sit from an organization point of view?
Yeah, so a majority of the workload that we have for Jazz Gaming is kind of a shared services model with the Utah Jazz. As a corporation, we actually have a whole bunch of properties that we own. The Larry Miller Group of Companies is kind of our overarching company, and we own car dealerships, we own movie theaters, we own the California Angels AAA baseball team. Are they called that anymore? It's the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I'm not a baseball guy. I apologize.
No, that's okay. And so is there a little bit of integration and promotion? Like, have the Jazz Gaming sort of appeared at Jazz Games? Is there stuff you do at the state at Vivint, or like how have you sort of cross promoted and those kind of things?
Yeah, so we actually have a few restrictions that we need to do with the league to keep it separate from the NBA. But we've gone in within what the kind of the restraints that we have, and we've tried to promote as much as we possibly can. A lot of the stuff that we're really trying to do, because obviously we're still in an awareness phase.
Yep.
A lot of the stuff that we've been doing is more local community stuff. We've had our players at the Jazz games and that, but we haven't really gone in and done anything to call them out as it is yet. We'd love to get to that point where we could do that a little bit more. But there's obviously some walls that have to kind of come down on that one for that one to happen. But like last night, we had our guys over at a Boys and Girls Club here in the Greater Salt Lake area and just had them play basketball and 2K with the guys there, the kids there, and they had a great time. And that's kind of our methodology now, is that we know that our audience in video games, the average video gamer is a 35-year-old male.
Yep.
Well, in just esports in general, you're more of an 18 to kind of 24, 25-year-old space there. But we also know that the people who generally get their start in playing 2K are probably in the 11 to 16-year-old age group. And so we're getting heavily involved with the Boys and Girls Clubs, with schools, with the STEM programs, because we know that that audience – if we get in and interact with them now, they're already playing the game, so they're very familiar with it. And so it's just us creating a relationship with this audience that already wants to be a part of it. And we've had a lot of success with that, and it's been a lot of fun to kind of interact that way.
So tapping into that, I guess, that local scene, Josh, like we were talking a little bit before we got started, you said that there's a strong history of video games and video and gaming in Utah. That's probably something that a lot of the listeners would not have picked or would not have known. Do you want to take us behind the scenes and sort of give us some info on that?
Yeah. So, We've obviously got the University of Utah that's just up the road from where we're at downtown Salt Lake. Yep. That they have a video game design program there called EAE. And they are typically in the number one spot in the nation for the video game, not only in undergraduate degrees, but also in the graduate program.
Okay.
So they've got a huge game development program there, but previous to that, there was an individual named Nolan Bushnell, who is a Utah, you know, native, born just kind of in northern Utah, just north of Salt Lake, who Nolan went to the University of Utah and then moved on to Silicon Valley area, where he went in and created Atari.
Okay.
And then he went in and one of his other projects was Chuck E. Cheese's, which, as everybody knows, is where a lot of people went to play video games.
Yep.
So yeah, he's a Utah native and actually up at the University of Utah right now in their EAE building, they have one of the original Pong upright arcades in there that he signed. So we have that there. And kind of in that whole thing, Utah is one of the fastest growing states in the nation. We've got one of the youngest populations, and we're one of the most tech savvy groups as well. We just kind of have, you know, this kind of lucky space to be in here where we've got the Silicon Slopes growing here, where we've got all of these tech companies that are building up. And we've got an entire valley just south of Salt Lake called Utah County. Yep. That there are two universities there between Brigham Young University and Utah Valley University that they are just churning out people who are creating all of these little startups, and they're coming with all sorts of these great ideas. And we have a lot of, you know, guys out there who are, you know, being a part of the independent gaming scene, building games and developing them. And I believe that I saw a tweet come out from the EAE program up at the U that they actually have 60 titles now that have been created and brought to development from the students up there that have been released, you know, into the wild for people to buy. That's actually really cool.
Wow.
So Utah kind of has that background in there to be able to, you know, as a small market, you know, from an MBA standpoint, that we carry a big stick around when we talk about what our involvement has been in video games and their creation. And then lest we forget, the University of Utah was also the first in the Power Five conference or Power Five schools to go in and have a varsity esports program.
Yep.
Where they have the scholarships, you know, for the students and that. So, yeah,
it does present a lot of opportunities for you in that in your role of director of esports and technology, because, you know, there's a whole bunch of cool stuff that's coming out of those, whether they be startups or, you know, talented folk that are in the space, that there's a way that you can say, well, you know, we've got a stadium and all this technology, and we're talking to fans all the time, and, you know, we've got all these events, and then on top of it, now we're in gaming and esports, and we're engaging this. It gives you a nice space to be able to have those conversations with those types of businesses and startups to sort of see, one, how can we help you, and then how can we integrate you in what we're trying to do.
Well, and the funny part is, too, when you have these conversations, you know, there's a lot of businesses who really don't understand that their employees are actually playing these games as well.
Yeah.
And that they're doing that in their personal time. And I'm of the opinion that we could probably, you know, put a kind of a blanket statement out there saying that more people than you would expect are gamers. And I would say that, you know, because like I look at my dad, who turned 70 this year, and he, like I said, he's an author. And when he sits down to his computer, when he needs to get through kind of brain blocks or whatever, he's the first one to open up Solitaire and start playing that on the computer. And yep. It's like, that's a computer game. That's a video game. It's a little bit different, but, you know, people have Candy Crush on their phone, and there's all these other ways that people go in and play video games. But at the end of the day, they're playing video games.
Yeah.
I
agree. It's like there is, you know, especially, I guess, in the techier the field, the more likely, you know, you being in tech, and, you know, there's more likely to talk to a lot of your staff and that they'll be gamers because they're drawn to tech, but it's getting wider and wider. But it's a little bit of who's a gamer here, and then if you know people start putting their hand up, it's not, it's becoming more prevalent for people to say and sort of wear it proudly. But
and
I do
socially acceptable too.
completely. And so that's where I think there is, you know, in the esports space at least, you know, part of the sponsorship sort of offering and connection for brands is a little bit of employee engagement and being able to acknowledge and having an engaged, you know, staff because you're either part of this story of supporting an esport or rolling out initiatives that, you know, have you know, tournament brackets that are, you know, inter-company tournament brackets where everyone's having playing a game in the same way, you know, we've played company softball in the past. Exactly. I think there's a lot of opportunities in that space.
Yep, absolutely.
So, Josh, before we get into the Sports Geek closing five, what are some of the best channels for people to connect with you and also Jazz Gaming?
Well, we can be found really easily. We use the same tag on everything. We're at Utah Jazz Gaming. Yep. We're found on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitch. And we'll go in and we do a weekly stream with our players in season. In the off season, we were actually doing quite a few streams during the week. As we move into the season, those numbers will probably drop down just a little bit. But we've got some great guys on our roster this year.
So with the streaming, are you just having the guys play and stream, or are you doing that and other content?
In the off season, we kind of just stuck to the games. But during the season, we're actually going to be looking to some unique content that we have. Being that we live in Utah and we've got the mountains so close to us, one of the things that we're going to be trying to do is a little bit more outdoor streaming.
Okay.
We've got some content ideas that are in development right now that will be focused on outdoors. And some of the things that, you know, that normal people do, but outdoors. And it's my technology side as well, that when you innovate, you got to try stuff to see if it works. And so we're going to do a few of those things. But yeah.
I look forward to it because I do think, you know, as someone sort of looking at the streaming space and I guess the products that are out there now, and a lot of it is, yeah, people streaming while they're playing the game and those kind of things. I do see an appetite for Twitch wanting more content that's non-game streaming and offering up that kind of piece. So we've been playing around with a Twitch chat show every week where we sort of recap the games and have some interviews and those kind of things. The last week we've been streaming our trials for our seconds team. So getting all the players playing and just having people talk over the top of that has been interesting. I'm always interested in hearing how other teams are trying new things with you know, especially with Twitch, to find out what works, because I think there's still a lot of opportunity for teams especially to do more content on that space. And I think there's definitely an appetite from Twitch to get more of that content.
Yeah, I was going to mention as well, we're looking at YouTube in a similar fashion also.
Oh, completely.
To see if we can go through and come up with kind of unique content for that as well. Just because, you know, we see that as another platform that has kind of a similar but sometimes different audience. So yeah, that's another platform that's great. So
terrific. And how can people send you a tweet? What's your Twitter handle?
Mine is a funky spelling, but my gamer tag is Spartacus. And
okay.
So I am Spartakuz. And that goes back to kind of my mentality of always having to fight, you know, and if anybody's familiar with the story of Spartacus taking on, you know, Rome.
Yep.
it was an uphill battle for him the whole time. And, you know, he gave him a headache, didn't necessarily go in his favor at the end, but that's my mentality is, get in there, you know, get a little scrappy and see if you can come out with a W. So,
terrific, terrific. We definitely leant on those, Roman themes when we're looking at the design for Gravitas, where we've got the sort of the Roman soldier mask as our icon. So I very much understand that that nature behind that name. The Sports Geek Closing Five. Do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
I don't remember in particular which the first one was, but yep. I do remember going to jazz games as a young guy in the early 80s. We were at what was called the Salt Palace at that time, which is now directly across the street from the Vivint Smart Home Arena. So I actually remember going in and seeing John Stockton and Karl Malone, you know, when I was probably 10 years old or so, and watching games. Because we have a youth basketball program that's actually we've won a couple of awards from the league on that called Junior Jazz. Yep. And we have about 60,000 kids, 60,000 kids who participate in that every year. And I grew up playing, you know, in that youth sports as well. And we used to do jazz game, junior jazz nights. And so that's one of the things that I remember is wandering around at a jazz game as a young kid.
In the early Stockton Malone era when shorts were short.
Yes. That was I don't know if anybody really wants to remember that anymore.
No, unfortunately, the people who do remember, apologies for that mental image, but that's what the era was. You must have been a few sports events now in your time and seen the food options change at from the Salt Palace to Vivint Smart Home Arena. Do you have a favorite food memory at a sporting event, or do you have a go-to food when you're at a sporting event?
Well, I am definitely not a hot dog person.
Okay.
So I don't enjoy those at all. But we actually have a food option at the Vivint Smart Home Arena right now that I love. It's a local place that's called Cup Bop. It's a Korean barbecue place, and kind of set up in there. So I love Korean barbecue. So that's kind of my go-to now is if I have a chance to eat that, I will.
Korean barbecue, that's very, you're very much in the gamer psyche there. Korean barbecue, I think it is one of the, it is high on the list of gamer foods I've found.
Oh, it's good.
What's the first app you open in the morning?
Mine is, it's either a mix of Instagram, Twitter, or Twitter, Instagram. Depending, it'll be one of those two that I open up.
Who do you suggest the Sports Geek podcast listeners should follow, whether it be a Twitter follow or maybe an author that you follow?
A lot of my mentality has been, it's completely kind of circled around from the innovation stuff and everything else like that. So, I follow Gary Vee, obviously. Yep. Back, you know, it's been 3 or 4 years ago when Simon Sinek actually, you know, started to be prominent with his TED Talk and all that. I used to follow him quite a bit, but Tim Ferriss with the 4-day work week and having that mentality of going through and, you know, being resourceful with what you have and all that, my mentality is kind of in that stuff, is thinking differently.
Yeah, so. Definitely. I love how Tim Ferriss is always has that. He's always testing different things to see how they work, and applying them.
I was going to say, I think to remain relevant in any of these spaces now that we talk about, you have to carry that mentality. Yep. Always have to be kind of in that mental refining where you go through and question why you're doing stuff and if it can be done better and all that stuff. So, yeah.
So, last question. What social media platform is your MVP? So, what's your go-to platform personally as Spartacus? And we'll put a link in the show notes so you can follow Josh. Or what's the go-to platform for Jazz Gaming?
Instagram is actually doing really, really well for us, yep. Even though we have a growing following. We are noticing that the followers that we have on Instagram are really engaged with us, and most of them are located here in Utah, which we have a larger following on Twitter, but they're kind of more of a global audience. And interesting enough, Twitter is really heavy for the esports world and video games. It still is a very thriving platform there, but just not as engaged. And I don't know if it's just due to how fast Twitter can move.
Yep.
But Instagram, definitely we get a lot more engagement out of our following off of there. And if you get good content up there with it, yeah, it's actually a lot of fun to be a part of that platform, because you get to see some unique stuff and kind of see it's more visual, which I like as well. Yeah. So yeah.
And you're finding that the players are leaning more into that as a platform as well, which is sort of working with the growth hand in hand.
Yeah, so we actually have a couple of players that we have on our roster this year that had never had an Instagram.
Yep.
Account before, and that was one of the ones where we asked them to go in and create one if they hadn't already, just because it provides another insight into kind of your life, because you get these slivers of moments and people are like, oh wow, that's really cool, I didn't know you could do that, or you know, wow, you got to go do this.
Yeah.
And it really plays to that experiential type of thing where people want experiences now, and they want to see, you know, what other people are doing in that same vein so that they can go in and potentially replicate that in their own life or whatever. So
definitely. I think we're working with my guys around just getting them more used to being content creators and getting comfortable in doing it. We started Tuesday Takeaways earlier this year, where all of the players send in a video and we share it just on our Instagram stories, and it's been amazing. Like week one, we were getting 5 and 10 second videos coming in of, it was a good week, and that's all we would get. And now we're like, guys, a minute is enough. We don't need to, you know, so they're getting more verbose and sharing a bit of personality. And, you know, they're not just doing the sports cliches of, oh, we did well and we did, you know, we want to do well next week. You know, they're sharing a few snippets of the behind the scenes of what's happening. And, you know, they're getting more comfortable and the fans are really enjoying the, I guess, the unique, unfiltered sort of content that they're getting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you very much for coming on the podcast. You can connect with Josh Barney on Twitter, as we said before, Spartacus, as S-P-R-T-A-K-U-Z, as we would say in Australia. Please send him a tweet, tell him that you've listened, or connect with Josh on LinkedIn. We'll put a link to Joshua Barney on LinkedIn. Please reach out. Tell him that you listen to the podcast. If you've got any questions about stadium technology and rolling that out, or esports, or old school gaming, you want a history of gaming, Josh is your man. Josh, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
New workshops on audience, content, distribution, valuation, and pitch following SportsGeek's Digital to Dollars process. Go to digitaltodollars.com.
Thanks again to Josh Barney. You can connect with him, as he said there earlier. His Twitter handle is Spartacus, S-P-R-T-A-K-U-Z. Or Z for those of you who are listening in Australia, or connect with him, Josh Barney, on LinkedIn. You can always go to the show notes for every episode of Sports Geek. In this case, it was episode 232. So simply putting in sportsgeekhq.com/232 and you'll find that episode. You can do that with any number prior to 232. If you put in 62, you'll find Mark Cuban's episode. Just to wrap up this episode, some of the things that have happened in my part of the world and what we've been up to. Last weekend, we were part of the Hype Sports Spin Accelerator Bootcamp up at University of Queensland. The Hype Spin Sports Accelerator is a global sports accelerator for sports tech companies. We were one of 25 companies that were there for the bootcamp, fighting it out for 12 spots. We were doing that under SG Esports and pitching SG Esports as a new sports tech company in the esports space. And it was a tremendous exercise the first day. On the Sunday, there was a lot of interviews with the judges and challenging of business models. And I really appreciated the process, as enjoyable as it is to get punched in the face and have your model and your beliefs and values challenged. That's the only way, I believe, to make the model better and really solidify your beliefs and be able to sell what we're trying to do at SG Esports. So I really do appreciate those punches in the face, because we did learn a lot. We didn't get through on the Sunday. There was five teams that got through on the Sunday. I had to come back and pitch on the Monday. So it was 13 teams that came back to pitch for the last seven spots, and we were lucky and very thankful to be selected with 11 other sports tech startups to be part of the cohort out of Australia. There's also one in Europe and Sweden, in Sweden and the UK, that will be running concurrently. So it's a 3-month accelerator. We're following online sessions with experts around the world. I'm really looking forward to the process and then the demo day in 3 months' time. And we'll have a fully refined pitch for SG Esports, but also some funding. So just to give you an idea of what the pitch is, and if people are wondering what SG Esports is, it is an esports media business, and that esports media business is pivoted around Gravitas is one of the key assets that the business currently owns, and it's built upon four key pillars. The first one being sponsorship, giving us the ability to connect brands with the world of esports and the esports market. Obviously, we're using Gravitas in a very similar way to professional and traditional sports teams, around doing things on jerseys, in events, and digital content players, which has been our bread and butter in Sports Geek for the last 10 years. So the opportunity to scale that piece is around acquiring more assets. If we run out of things to sell around Gravitas, the opportunity is to take that model and acquire more assets, whether they be teams or other assets that can help sponsors connect with fans. The second pillar is membership, and figuring out what membership looks like in the esports space. We think there's a real opportunity to connect with fans of esports and gaming fans overall. They've shown a high propensity to spend a lot of money at events like PAX and Comic-Con and the like. They like exclusive access and collectibles. And so we're going to produce a membership product that targets that fan. It's going to be of high value. They're going to be able to go around in a member exclusive hoodie and a merch pack and some fan events, and connect them with our players and have that exclusive access and do that at a high value. So we're looking to launch that in the coming weeks before our second season starts in June. And then the other part that I think is really critical is grassroots. I think there's a real underdevelopment and underdeveloped connection with the grassroots space in the esports scene and the gaming scene. So we're lucky enough, and we'll be announcing it soon, we've formed a partnership with a large community group that runs online leagues and tournaments and connects that grassroots community around League of Legends here in Australia. So we're looking forward to helping them commercialize their group and bring sponsors to be able to activate and connect with the grassroots gamer. And I think that is a model that will work across multiple regions and also multiple titles. So I think it flows back into that sponsorship pillar to provide assets in that space. And then our last pillar sort of leans on the Sports Geek heritage. There is a lot of sports tech solutions that are being offered into the sports market, and they will be looking at the attractiveness of esports as a market and as an opportunity. And what we'll be able to do with SG Esports and with Gravitas is be able to leverage our industry knowledge, being an insider now from a point of view of owning a team, but then also use Gravitas as a means to help them understand the market and offer the potential tweaks to that space. So, and it's pretty much similar to what we've done with Pixstar, opening up the esports as a vertical for their products. So they're the four pillars that SG Esports as a media business it was part of the pitch and part of the winning pitch that got us into Hype. I want to have a shout out to my fellow cohorts, Heartbeat Interactive, Inspire on Sport Online, Movosity, Bib, Pumal, Quipmo, Siren Media, My Call by Sports Tech Industries, Sports Cube, Stata, and Stata Sports. So I'll put links once the official announcement goes out But really looking forward to working with those. But I think what is also really important and what was a really nice surprise and to see some familiar faces there was that three of those teams, including SG Esports, are in the Sports Geek Nation. So Jason Davis at Siren Media is in Sports Geek Nation, and so is Rory Osman from Stata. So it's really pleasing to see that the community around Sports Geek Nation is also having some success. I've posted something in Sports Geek Nation, a photo we took at the event. And so with that, to celebrate that that piece, we are opening up access to Sports Geek Nation for 1 week only. So you've got a chance to get in and be part of the community, engage, be part of the AMAs that are happening every week, get access to ask the questions and see all the questions and answers. So what you have to do, and you have to do this before May 2019, we're only going to turn this on for a week. You have to go to sportsgeeknation.com/hype. Now, I'm going to say that again because this is not going to go in the show notes. This is only going out to podcast listeners. You have to get to this part of the podcast to find out about this link. If you're not part of Sports Geek Nation now, this is your chance to get in this week. sportsgeeknation.com/hype. And with that, you will get access to the Slack community. You'll be added to the Sports Geek Nation Facebook group. You'll get part of the weekly AMAs. You'll get our monthly email, and all benefits of connecting with people like Jason at Siren Media and Rory at Stata, as well as other sports executives from around the world. And I hope to see more people have success, whether it be moving to a new job or getting funding and seeing their sports startups grow. That's it from me for this week. Until next time, as always, remember, especially if you want to book in one of the Pick My Brain sessions, simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/pickmybrain for one of those 2 hour sessions to kick off a project or an initiative, or just to kick off a potential working relationship with myself and what we do here at Sports Geek. Until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Follow our League of Legends esports team at gravitas.gg. For more resources, go to sportsgeekhq.com. Looking for new campaign ideas to drive new and fresh data and leads? Contact Sean to find out how SportsGeek can help you drive fans into your stadium. It's all about the cheeks in the seats.